I'm Michael, and welcome to Beyond the Screenplay, the podcast where each week we do a conversational deep dive analysis into a film. Today, we are talking about The Lord of the Rings, The Fellowship of the Ring.
Yay!
There's a lot of excitement around this 2001 film directed by Peter Jackson, screenplay by Fran Walsh, Philippa Boyens, and Peter Jackson, based on the novel by J.R.R. Tolkien. I'm joined by the Beyond the Screenplay team, Trisha Arand.
Hello, everybody.
Brian Bittner.
Hello, hello.
And Alex Calleros.
Hi.
So before we jump into this episode, we all want to thank the patrons for making this possible. Mm-hmm. We hit our goal of passing 500 patrons on Patreon, which unlocked this three-part series that we are beginning today on Lord of the Rings, culminating in a patron-exclusive episode on The Hobbit Trilogy, which is going to be a lot of fun. So thank you to all of you guys that have made this possible. We love you. And now we get to talk about Lord of the Rings. So we're very excited about that.
Yeah.
Let us begin our journey through Middle Earth. So I think it'd be fun to kind of talk about our first experiences with Lord of the Rings and how that journey has progressed over time. So like, I remember seeing the movies when they first came out. I was in high school, 2001. I was, 14, 15, I guess? And I remember going to the theater, basically because it was, there was so much hype around it, and mm-hmm. It was this huge new thing. I am not someone that likes my fantasy with swords and horses and dragons. I prefer my fantasy with lightsabers and spaceships. So there was a lot of hurdles in the way for me. But I kind of got into it watching this first movie, The Fellowship, in the theater, despite all these, like, the barriers that I had. But I remember being very upset at the end of the movie when it just ended. Mm-hmm. And I was like, wait, they didn't do the ring. Like, what? Yeah. It just ended. I knew that there were going to be more, but I didn't know it was like three parts and not, you know, three movies, more like Star Wars, where each one is a self-contained thing. Mm-hmm. So I went in skeptical, got hooked, and then was upset basically until The Two Towers. And then around the time The Two Towers came out is when I really got into it and then became obsessed. And when the DVDs came out, that's when I watched them all over and over again. But I hadn't watched them probably in 10 years. It's definitely been a long time. So it was fun to revisit and relive the memories and relive the filmmaking that was happening in 2001. There's a lot of, it's weird to have lived through an era of filmmaking that I think is distinct enough to go back and mm-hmm. watch and be like, oh yeah, that's kind of how they made movies 20 years ago, which is weird.
Literally been 20 years.
Mm-hmm. Yes. But so Alex, what about you? I want to hear your journey with Lord of the Rings.
I was a freshman in high school when Fellowship came out. And the year before in eighth grade, I read The Hobbit and like did a book report on it in English class. So mm-hmm. I was familiar with The Hobbit and I liked The Hobbit. And so I knew the kind of backstory going into Lord of the Rings, but I had not read the actual Lord of the Rings trilogy, the books. So I went into the movie, you know, already liking the story world and excited to see what it meant to have this whole story after The Hobbit. So I was pretty hooked from the beginning. As soon as Gollum appeared in like the opening prologue, I was like, oh my God, it's like from The Hobbit. And like, uh-huh. there's the Hobbit. So the movie had me because of my previous knowledge of some Middle Earthiness. Mm-hmm. I had the same experience of, you know, I was just kind of immersed in this story world for the duration of the film, and then had that weird feeling of like, wait, what? Like, we just faded to black. Wait, that was it. That's Mordor right there. And they're like walking towards it. And like, this is the part where they like put the ring in the fire, but like, what? And of course, you know, now looking back on it, we have so many movie franchises like the whole Avengers Marvel thing where you kind of expect these movies to be installments that don't really have their own self-contained conclusion. But this was really new, I think, at the time. Like, I had never seen movies at this scale kind of being treated like installments in more of like an episodic series. Mm-hmm. So it was disconcerting. And so I left the theater with kind of like an awkward feeling of like, I don't know what to make of that. But then I saw it multiple times in theaters, got obsessed, got the DVDs, got the extended editions, watched all the special features, which mm-hmm. made me fall in love with the movies like 10 times more. Because, you know, at that time, that was about the peak of my like aspiring filmmakerness. And these movies really pushed me over the edge. And I really credit the incredible behind the scenes featurettes on those extended edition DVDs with really like cementing my dedication to film, because watching this team in New Zealand of, you know, not Hollywood types, but these like very earnest, the Weta Workshop and Peter Jackson and Philippa Boyens and the whole cast and crew, this like lovable band of New Zealanders who just really wanted to make these awesome movies and did it with so much heart and love and lack of cynicism. It was everything that I imagined like making a great movie could be. And they were doing it like in the way that I wanted to be doing it. These movies have a very special place in my heart because they really are the reason maybe why I'm here, because I had those early Steven Spielberg inspirations, but I think Peter Jackson and his vision and the love in these movies is what cemented it of like, no, I want to make movies. I want to be in that crew in New Zealand doing this. This is like the life I want. So, yeah. So thank you, Lord of the Rings, for that.
Cool. Trisha, what about you?
Yeah. It has been a journey, I guess. I didn't like this movie when it came out. But that was not the movie's fault. That was like a weird situation I was in. I was the same age as you guys, Michael and Alex. So probably a freshman in high school. And the hype around this movie was incredible, which is interesting to think about considering what it's adapted from, which was a fantasy novel from the late 1950s that like our hippie parents were into. And, you know, maybe we can get into some of the history of all of that. But like, there was a huge wave of epics that happened between 1995 and like 2005, essentially, where before superhero movies were the biggest budget thing that you could make, an epic was the biggest budget thing that you could make.
And Braveheart, Troy, Gladiator.
Studios really were making that. Braveheart was 1995. Titanic was 1997. 1998 was Shakespeare in Love, Saving Private Ryan, The Thin Red Line. So there's war epics there. Phantom Menace was 99. Like 2000, Gladiator, Crouching Tiger. Like these 3-hour kind of like big, sweeping, romantic, huge movies. And then 2001, if you remember, was Fellowship, also the first Harry Potter movie, was based on like an enormous book series. And then they were also making historical epics. They made Pearl Harbor, they made A Beautiful Mind, which was this big, you know, award winner thing. Planet of the Apes they made as well in 2001. They made a ton of these. And for this one, for me, just kind of was like, I'm a Star Wars person myself, and I hadn't read the books and I didn't know anything about them. Hadn't read The Hobbit. So the hype really just kind of like didn't do much for me. And then I got talked into going to see Fellowship late in the run, which it ran forever. It was in theaters forever. But a friend of mine talked me into going to see it. And even like months into the run, it was like in a big sold out show. And she had seen it like 2 or 3 times already. And she was like, come with me and see it. So we sat there, and then she ditched me in the movie theater and left me there to go get Chinese food and never came back. And
how dare she?
I mean, I to this day don't understand it. So I was left sitting by myself in like the last row of the movie theater, seeing a movie I didn't know anything about that I didn't have any connection to. Wow. That was really dark and darker than I thought it was going to be. And we can talk about the darkness, but I really didn't like it since then.
Lots of emotional like reasons. Yeah.
Well, baggage. Yeah, right. I was 14. Yeah. Since then, I have come to just respect so much about these movies and like of all of the epics that I named. And I have a whole list that I could keep going because they kept making them after this because they were still making all the money and winning all the awards. But out of this entire huge list of epics that they made from 1995 to basically all the way until Avatar, which was sort of the last great epic. I mean, is it better? I think it is better than any single one of the prequels to the Star Wars prequels. I think it's more fun to watch than Saving Private Ryan or Braveheart or The Last Samurai or Master and Commander. Like those historical epics don't quite have the same thing as this. And yet in a lot of ways, even though this is fantasy, it feels like a historical epic. And so I don't know, we can get into that too, but I just, these are really, really great, well-made films. And nothing but respect in my heart. It's really, really impressive.
Yeah, absolutely. I feel like regardless of how you your personal feelings on the movies or how you enjoyed them or whatever.
Right.
I feel like respect must be paid to these movies.
Yes.
They are
big time.
Epic. And they made the hell out of them.
Yeah, they did.
Kind of a miracle that they got made at all and they are what they are. Right. It's like so many miracles.
For sure.
For sure. Brian, tell us about your relationship with Lord of the Rings.
Yeah, like Alex, I had read The Hobbit, and I actually read it, I think, in fourth grade. So it was like very formative for me, The Hobbit and Phantom Tollbooth and, you know, some of these other books, some of which were not fantasy things. But I just remember like wanting to learn runes and would like sketch runes on things like at, you know, 8 years old or something. I'm like, runes. And yeah, something about just the magic of it and the woodsiness of it and all that kind of stuff. I just really love The Hobbit. So yeah, I read it again, I think in seventh grade. So, and I tried to read Lord of the Rings when I was around that age and I was just too young. I was like 12 or 13. It was just, you know, I almost stepped outside of my body and was like, I think you're too young for this. Like an older me stepped in and said, just hang on. But yeah, so I definitely came to Middle Earth with that love. And then when the movies were coming out, I really didn't pay that much attention to it. I was in college. I was like 19. I was at the most cynical, you know, stage of my life, probably. So I was just, oh, Hollywood is taking this book and turning it into a movie. Elijah Wood is playing the main Hobbit. That seems ridiculous, you know, this like American pretty boy. So I wasn't like anti it as much as I just was very kind of, we'll see kind of thing. And I did see it in the theater and I thought it was cool. Like I didn't actually have a strong reaction to it in the theater, but then you're in college. So of course you go find the screener and you watch it again with your friends after like during award season. Mm. So I watched it again and I started to kind of something started to click a little, but I liked it enough that then when the extended DVD came out, I bought that sort of came like this leather bound book with all the discs inside.
Yeah.
And like sketches
and
everything.
Among the coolest DVDs ever.
Yeah. Yes, I'm so sad.
Absolutely.
I don't have it
really.
The box sets have gotten more expensive and less cool as they get more and more high def, which makes me sad. Watching the extended version of Fellowship, I really fell in love with the movie, just getting more of that character work and those little moments, which we can talk about later. But it actually felt like a shorter movie to me. Like it felt because it wasn't sort of, now we're going here, now we got to go here. It sort of felt like it was taking time to breathe. And that was where I started to really connect to it. And then, like you said, Alex, just watching the special features, all the little featurettes and everything, watching it with commentary with the cast. And it just gave me this like very warm feeling of these movies were made with a lot of love and by people who loved each other and were very serious about what they were doing. And it just made me sort of fall in love with not just the movies, but with the production of the movies and with everything sort of surrounding them, the music and the artwork and everything. There's a video game, Battle for Middle Earth. It's like a real-time strategy game from 2003 or something. And I'll play that game every couple of years just because they use like Howard Shore's music and they use some clips from the movies. And I'm just like, I get to be inside Middle Earth and not in the way of like, it's a more arcadey game where you're like fighting. It's like, I know I'm looking down on my like little town that I'm building. It's just little things like that where it's like, I have such a connection to that world that even something that reminds me of it, like hearing the score or something, will just bring me back to that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think the love that you're talking about is like palpable almost. And like as much as Middle Earth is a world that you can get lost in, I feel like the movies themselves and the lore around the movies, and especially that era where DVDs were at, you know, the height of their popularity and they could release 3-hour documentaries for each one where you could go and like just soak in every little piece of, you could see the care they put into making the chain mail, like chain by chain, just the minutiae and like all of that. As deep as the world of Middle Earth is, I feel like the world of these movies is also as deep. And that's kind of, I think, what sucks people in and lets them like just get lost in the experience of these movies.
I have the number written down, 19,000 costumes.
Mm-hmm.
19,000. Sure.
1,800 hobbit feet just for the four hobbits.
Yeah.
Wow.
People are crazy.
Nothing half-assed here. No. Nothing phoned in.
Yeah.
No, just, exactly. And that, yes, because of the commercialism surrounding a lot of epics, you know, again, standing this next to something like Phantom Menace, it doesn't feel like a money grab in the same way because the IP is sort of so pure and hadn't been like plumbed and recycled and all of that stuff. It's just like, here are these books that maybe you read or your parents read. And it doesn't matter either way. We're going to plunge you so deeply into this world and really immerse you in it. And maybe we'll sell a ton of like little gold rings on chains like Ryan is wearing right now. But that's not why we're making these movies, you know?
Yeah, it's almost like the spirit of making the movie fits with the theme of the movie, of this like courage of just doing this thing without a guarantee of success. And I think it's just beautiful.
Right. And also Tolkien, who spent his entire life creating this world, he made one of the most comprehensive mythologies that exists.
Yeah.
And then it's very fitting that then the movies are some of the most comprehensive movies in terms of all of the care that went into, you know, they're like, oh, we sketched like character stuff inside of the armor so that the actor wearing them, like stuff that's totally unnecessary, but just shows how much they cared about it. Peter Jackson actually said, I know this is silly, but I want you guys to think of this as this was history. And we are actually filming, we're recreating the events that actually happened on location where they happened. And he said it with a, I know this is silly. Like he's not, he wasn't like, I actually believe this or anything. But everybody, when you watch the features and stuff, everybody went into this movie with just the most amount of, this is not teehee, we're making a movie with trolls and dwarves and stuff. This was, we are making a serious thing. And you had the entire country of New Zealand banding together to make this thing as extras, as voices in the choir, as jewelers and armorers and blacksmiths, you know, like everybody was involved in making this thing. And I think that just, and that shows.
It's like we said before, I think it's just so pure. There's there's something so pure about it through and through, which you really can't replicate or imitate. It's just this lightning in a bottle thing that happened. And I'm just so happy that it happened and that we can always have it, you know, to look back on. Because not many movie franchises can feel this way. And we'll get to The Hobbit eventually, but it certainly didn't feel the same way to me.
Right.
It's finally 2021, and I, for one, am very excited to spring into this new year with a renewed sense of purpose and discipline. One of the ways I do this is by reviewing productivity tips from some of my favorite creators. So I revisited Thomas Frank's Skillshare class, Productivity Masterclass, Create a Custom System That Works. In just 10 lessons that totaled just over an hour in length, I was reminded of all the techniques Thomas uses to stay productive and to work smart instead of hard. By incorporating his techniques, my new year has already felt like one of the best in recent memory. And what's even better is that Thomas just released a new class on Skillshare called Productivity for Creatives. Build a system that brings out your best. The lessons he discusses in this new class are so important for people who want to get serious about their creative output. Because, as author James Clear says, you do not rise to the level of your goals, you fall to the level of your systems. So make the most of 2021 by joining Skillshare at skillshare.com/beyondthescreenplay, where our listeners get a free trial of premium membership. Once again, that's skillshare.com/beyondthescreenplay. Thanks to Skillshare for sponsoring this episode, and thanks to Thomas Frank for making me a little bit more productive.
Well, and it has, Brian, what you were saying reminded me just of the travel to, I don't know, it transports you away to a world that is so unfamiliar to you, but is completely real.
Mm-hmm.
So if you stand this against something like Avatar, you're just like, okay, great, Pandora, that's a CGI world. And people really love Pandora, so I'm not trying to say anything
bad about it. They get depression.
Be careful.
Because they don't live on Pandora.
I know. Do they really still? I don't know. Avatar fans, tweet at me. I need to know. The transportation element of when you watch these, it takes you away to this other world that is like, these mountains are real, the fields and valleys and everything about it is, I don't know. It just, this thing that Peter Jackson said about it feeling historical, I think it's because it's so rooted in place.
Right.
Yes.
New Zealand, I think I want to say it's like 30% of New Zealand's, you know, income is like tourism, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not all Middle Earth. tourism. Right. But a lot of it is, New Zealand is just an incredible place. But a lot of it is, you know, these films popularized real places that still feel fantastical, and yet they are real. There's something just magic about that fact that these movies access that I think also is a big part of this.
There's something really special about, you know, this film, I think more than two or three, really has the classic quest feeling. You know, it's there's a band of characters and they have these episodic, you know, scenes along this long quest across space, and they cross through so many different environments. They're up on the tallest mountain peak, they're in forests, they're in a mine, they're all over the place. And it's such pure fantasy, because we've all played like video games since Lord of the Rings, like Skyrim, or which replicate the same experience of just traversing space across these like gorgeous environments. And this first film, Fellowship, you know, because all the places are real, it's so special. Like there's other films that have done the kind of quest, you know, format, but most of them don't take place in a country like New Zealand, where every location is on location and it's not CGI, it's not a set. Like they're actually on that mountain, they're actually on this in this valley. It's so special for that reason. I can't think of any other quest movie that quite feels the same way, where you have this many types of landscapes in one film.
I just want to watch shots of like people running on a hilltop with like helicopter shot and the music playing. I'm like, I could just watch that for an hour.
Yeah.
Yeah. That feeling of exploration is really there.
Right.
Absolutely.
And another thing with Tolkien creating this world is he actually hated allegory. He hated the idea that you would make a movie or a book that was speaking directly to what was going on at the time. So when people say, oh, Sauron, Hitler, he's like, no, Sauron is Sauron. Like it is, he wanted to create his own history from the ground up. And a lot of scholars champion that as the reason why it continues to feel timeless, because it's not, well, you have to understand what was going on in 1937 to understand yada, yada, you know? And I think that's true. And I don't think it's bad to have allegory. I don't think it's bad. Like, I think art should speak to the time, but I also think there's something special about creating something that is just meant to be its own thing. Mm-hmm. At the same time, you'll hear scholars in the same sentence talk about how Tolkien hated technology and how the ring sort of represents technology, and like the trees are, you know, tearing, Saruman's tearing down the trees to make things, da da da. And it's like, okay, so you hated allegory to a certain extent, but there is a difference. Right. But there's a difference between sort of speaking to something that is happening in this exact year versus pretty universal ideas that will always be there, you know?
Right. Well, yeah, to me, it feels like it's just kind of like one step removed, where like there could be evil happening today that is inspiring you, but instead of making it about that specific evil and just trying to recreate that, find the root evil, like evil as it exists in humanity, and then make a story about that more universal, you know, human struggle of things. And I think that is why it does feel timeless, is because it's about these timeless things and power and humanity and what it means to exist with the earth that we live in and stuff. And so it's not like there aren't ideas in there. It's that they're applied in such a way that it can be accessed from any time and from any perspective, and not just one time and place. Mm-hmm.
I think one reason the books are challenging to read is because Tolkien was openly trying to create a mythology for England. He was trying to make his own kind of from the ground up, like deep, like myth for his country, because he felt that England didn't have like a really like an ancient myth to draw from because of various invasions across history. And his work is so dense, and there's so many like, this guy, son of this guy, son of this guy, and there's like different kinds of elves. And it's like, what? Why is all this in here? But you look at ancient Greek myths and, you know, other kinds of mythologies, and they are as weird and dense and almost too detailed. And there's something about the movies that capture that sense of myth, like the way Fellowship opens with Cate Blanchett's voice over Black speaking, you know, these almost like timeless words. It almost feels like deep history at the beginning is being spoken of.
I think every movie should begin with Cate Blanchett speaking over Black also. Like, I think that's never a bad idea.
Right. Leading into your opening title.
Mm-hmm. Alex, what you were saying about this movie feeling like the most pure sort of story arc I really think is true in terms of it being a quest, because it is just this mythological, simple quest narrative. Here's the ring. It has to go to Mordor, and we're going to send these people on the way to get it. It is this, you know, the myth of the one, essentially, like Frodo is the only one that can take it there. And it's got that like Joseph Campbell, like hero's journey, like deep mythology to it. But it's a very clean and simple story. And it does this like very, very well. And we can talk about this when we get to the other movies, brings together all of the people that are needed. Right. And so like a big part of the journey becomes about the interpersonal dynamics and the difficulties of the ring, which is what you were saying, Michael, which is like, this is a movie about greed. Right. And like a lust for power and how different people are able to sort of like manage and navigate that as they're like striving toward a singular purpose. And so I think with this, especially, you know, the other movies in my mind get like convoluted when they become battle and war movies. Mm-hmm. But because this movie is so focused on these nine people, this particular collection of people and the team itself, I feel like there's something deeply personal about Fellowship that makes it my favorite of the three movies, for sure.
Yeah, so it's interesting because when these movies came out in theaters, I had so much hype between films. And, you know, I read the books like after seeing Fellowship in theaters. So my hype for these movies like grew exponentially. And I was checking the OneRing.net every day for like news updates about the next movie.
Adorable.
Because of that, like I had so much invested in Two Towers and Return of the King that like, you know, those became the new exciting thing. Mm-hmm. But 20 years later, revisiting these films, I think my favorite, if I have to choose one piece of this saga to name as like my favorite, I think extended edition Fellowship of the Ring actually is my favorite. Mm-hmm. Because it feels like the most complete and intentional and kind of like steady of the three films. It feels like everything in Fellowship was really deliberate and every shot is what it's supposed to be. And I think in Two Towers Return of the King has some of the highest highs, but also a lot of lows for me. And I could feel in the second two movies sometimes, oh, this kind of feels like a reshoot, or like we had to kind of change the story here, so we're kind of twisting it on the fly. Whereas Fellowship, I don't know if this is true, but it feels almost entirely of like the original shoot or of the original plan, in a way that there's parts of Two Towers and Return of the King that feel a bit more hastily put together, as if they had to change something midstream. So anyway, yeah, just long story short, I was surprised upon this rewatch to realize, wow, the one that I kind of had forgotten about because it was like not the exciting one for a while, maybe is my favorite and feels the most just like solid. Like this movie feels solid from start to finish.
Yeah.
I basically had the same experience where my memory of it was, I don't really ever need to watch Fellowship again because like that's just like it's set up and blah, blah, blah. And like it was more fun to like watch the other two, and watching them all again, the Fellowship of the Ring like blew me away and made me the most emotional out of all of them. And I think there is a lot of things we can talk about with the filmmaking. I don't think you can say that any of the filmmaking in this feels like elegant or like super deliberate. Like it still kind of feels like they had to shoot just a bunch of stuff and then in the edit they put it together and made it into a movie. This one does feel the most focused in terms of the things that it's tracking and that you as the audience are tracking, which I think helps make it feel the most cohesive, because you're not having to set up, here's Rohan and here's all the people that live there, and we can talk about all that in the Two Towers. What it does so powerfully that I was really impressed by is the way it sets up the stakes of the world and the ring, and the way you really buy into it, because it's kind of a goofy thing. Again, me coming into this with not like a love of fantasy, it's like, wait, somebody made a ring and somehow the ring equals all power, like vaguely. There are these moments when you're watching the film where different people are reaching for the ring, or when Boromir and Frodo are in the woods toward the end, and it's just kind of like Sean Bean putting on like a one act play of him.
Right. It's very like Shakespearean.
Yeah.
Right. But it's so tense because you're like, oh no, the ring is going to seduce him. And like no one else can put on the ring. Like it really makes you buy into this, the power of the ring and that Frodo is the only person that can bear it. And I think it does that in so many ways, but that was the thing I was really impressed by, is that all the things, even the orcs and the Uruk-hai, even when they look like CG from 20 years ago, there's danger attached to them. Mm-hmm. And so you feel the mm-hmm. weight and the threat that they're all up against. And I think it's just really, really impressive how they were able to convey that and make it such a thrilling filmic experience, because you have the weight of those stakes with you the whole time.
There's so much exposition they have to do in this first film. And mm-hmm. I think it's brilliantly done. The way, like, the first half of the film does so much exposition, but it does it across so many scenes. And all of those scenes are doing more than one thing at once and have conflict and tension. It's like there's so many rules and so many historical things to learn about to understand this story, and it's so effortless in this film, and there's so many ways it could not have been. Mm-hmm. But they really pulled it off in Fellowship.
It's a movie that rewards watching again, because I think right. Especially as a 14, 15 year old watching it the first time, it is hard to jump into this world because it is so dense and so thought out. And like you were saying, Trish, it feels real, but that means it's kind of like, wait, I missed the history lesson where I'm supposed to know what's going on and where is where. And Sauron is different than Saruman, but they're both bad wizards. And like Aragorn is Strider, but he's also Aragorn, but he's also the king. Like there's a lot of things and names to keep track of. And I think that's why when I watched it, when it came out on DVD, I turned on subtitles, and that's when I was finally able to be like, oh, okay, that's that person. And then you do appreciate how much is being set up really efficiently and cinematically all at the same time.
Which I think is why I appreciate the extended editions, because, especially of this movie, because you get those little character moments. You know, I think probably my favorite little moment is in this movie, which is when Frodo wakes up and Aragorn's singing, and he's singing about Beren and Luthien, which is this tale of Luthien. Elf maiden gave her love to a mortal man, da da da, and that's where they took from that history to expand on Aragorn and Arwen's relationship, because there wasn't a ton of that in the books. But you know, Frodo wakes up and he hears Aragorn singing kind of sadly to himself, and then he says like, "Who was she, this woman you sing of?" And he explains, "Luthien, she was immortal, but she gave her love to a mortal man." And Frodo says, "What happened to her?" And he just says, "She died." And it's mm-hmm. just like this quiet moment that to me is just like, oh, now I know who you are. Like all these extended scenes, not all of them, but a lot of them feel like the, you know, the aliens, Ripley's daughter scene, where it's like, hey, mm-hmm. all, you know, all that stuff that explains who this character is, the studio's like, nah, get rid of that. Let's get to the action quicker, you know? And that's not to say every single extended scene has that weight to it, but it's one of those moments where I just feel like in 4 lines, I got to know Aragorn so much more than in the previous hour of the movie.
Michael, I think you were mentioning on this watch through of like, you're like, I'm going to do Two Towers extended, but I'm not doing Fellowship extended. Mm-hmm. And I think it's ironic, because revisiting the extended editions, I think Fellowship by far is the best of the extended edition cuts, because there's something about the pace. Brian, you mentioned it earlier. The movie almost feels faster paced in a weird way, even though it's like 30, 40 minutes longer. It feels like every like chapter of the journey, or every kind of episode in the journey, feels more complete and feels more satisfying. So you're not really in this kind of whiplash mode of like, okay, on to the next thing. Oh, this movie's still going. You're kind of more in this like episodic mindset. And the reason I love this extended cut more than the others, even though there are some crucial scenes I would put back into Two Towers, especially. Mm-hmm. In Two Towers extended cut and Return of the King extended cut especially, I could see a lot of why things were cut. It was like, well, this, like, it's just not a great performance here, or this is kind of awkward, and like, this is just like good to cut out maybe for a lot of reasons and not just mm-hmm. because of time. Fellowship of the Ring extended cut, almost nothing that's put back in feels like it was, you know, it would have been cut for reasons besides time. Like, mm-hmm. like it was cut for time, but not because it was like, eh, it's not a great scene. All the little moments that are put back in are really special moments. And I agree with you. I think you feel a richer relationship with all the characters, including Boromir. Like Boromir's story feels more complete in the extended cut of Fellowship to the point where his like drawn out death scene and drawn out kind of final monologue with Aragorn as he's dying feels more earned to me in the extended cut. So mm-hmm. I encourage you, Michael, if you ever watch these movies again, watch Fellowship Extended, because I think it really is the best of them all.
Yeah. Well, and this was my first time watching the extended cuts all the way through. Like, I'd kind of seen some of the missing scenes in the way that, like, we were doing, you know, when the DVDs came out, where it's like, oh, check that scene out. That's cool. That, you know, adds this information. But I'd never, up until, you know, a couple of weeks ago when we started planning for this, sat down and watched the extended cuts all the way through. And the Fellowship cut super impressed me for the reasons you guys are talking about. And it reinforced the reasons that I like Fellowship the most. As I was saying, it's the most character driven of the movies. Like, what is driving the plot are the character decisions here. And there are not all of these larger, like, you know, war sort of.
The world of men will fall.
Yeah. It's pretty grandiose. It's just all of that stuff. And I don't, you know, I do find that compelling as the trilogy goes on. But this movie starts us super wisely off with a little history lesson, but the history lesson is contained and focused to the history of the ring. This is all you need to know. Here's the, you know, world of men and blah, blah, blah. But really, this is about the ring. And then the ring came to Bilbo. And that's all you need to know about it. Mm-hmm. Like, here's where it is now today. It's an extremely dangerous object. Now a hobbit has it. And then we get to know a little bit about Bilbo, which is really important context. We get to know a little bit about Frodo, but then we're starting to see as these different characters that are interacting with the ring start to make their decisions and propel the plot. It's all out of their own, like, character sort of desires and obligations. And I love the design of Frodo here. It really reminds me of, we were talking in the Terminator 2 podcast talking about Sarah Connor as like an every woman or just like an average person who is in no way special and in no way qualified to handle this sort of like, hi, you're the mother of the revolution now, and therefore machines will try to kill you for the rest of your life. Right? It's a very similar situation with Frodo, where, like, you know, a lot of times, you know, and I mentioned it earlier, the quote unquote myth of the one, you have somebody like Harry Potter, who is already special in some way by the time that we meet him when he's 10 years old. Or you have somebody like Luke Skywalker, who, as it turns out, is already special by the time that we meet him, you know? And Frodo is not special. It just happens to fall to him. And I think that there's something super powerful about that, the design of that character as a central figure, where he just inherits the ring. And he tries to give it away, right? Like any good call to adventure, refusal of a call, when he accepts that it has like come to him. And that's why I think the Council of Elrond is like so, such a crucial scene in this.
Talk about a midpoint. Midpoint.
But he realizes that it has fallen to him. Again, we have these difficult, the characters are continually being forced into difficult decisions that are then revealing character. And those decisions are propelling the events of the plot. Not outside activities that are swooping in or coincidences. It's all character driven stuff that takes them from point A to point B, which is almost to Mordor, but not at all.
Not at all, apparently. Two more movies.
Yeah.
Frodo is in every Hobbit.
Yeah.
He is.
and like with Sarah Connor, Frodo is targeted. Like Luke Skywalker could just go live with a friend forever and nothing would change.
Totally.
You know, but both Frodo and Sarah Connor, it's like this burden is on you now, whether you like it or not. Yeah.
Yeah. I think that's really compelling.
Well, and I think, you know, revisiting this film, I realized this really is Frodo's film in a way that the last
other two
aren't. Yeah. Cause he is the one making these proactive decisions at every major plot point. You know, when he has to decide, I can't give this ring to Gandalf. He'll turn into a monster, I guess. So I'm going to have to get this ring to Bree. Okay, Gandalf's not here. I have to get it to Rivendell. But now I'm done. Like, I did my duty. Mm-hmm. Wait, only a hobbit can actually handle this burden. I'm going to have to do it. And at the end of the movie, the real final decision is I'm going to have to do it alone. Like, I can't even have these people around me because it's going to take all of them. And only Sam has the good enough heart to resist it.
Sam.
Sam.
It's a real arc.
It's a beautiful kind of clean character arc. And at every step of the journey, he's resisting this truth. And the truth, which Galadriel basically spells out for him, is like, if you don't do this, nobody will. Mm-hmm. And that's a really hard truth for Frodo to accept as just an every hobbit, as you said.
Yeah, well, and it's so powerful, I think, to me, because it doesn't sugarcoat any of it. Like, this part of the epicness of these movies is, I think, also that it has every tone, that it can be lighthearted and goofy and silly, and sometimes even like Star Wars prequely, and some of the like the goofy jokes that like get made. That's a little silly. But then it also goes to the like the dark, deep weight of responsibility to do this thing that is probably a death sentence, but like no one else can. So are you going to be the person that does what, that tries to do what no one else can do? And I think that, you know, being able to access all of those emotions and all those themes makes it not just epic on a visual grand scale, but also on an emotional scale. And it lets you, that's again what I was kind of struck by the end, is sort of that choice, like you're talking about, where Frodo realizes he has to do it alone and is still willing to do it. And then Sam is like, okay, yeah, you have to do it alone, but I'm going with you. Like, yeah. I just love
it. What a beautiful line. Of course you are. And I'm coming with you.
It was weird because I know, like, I always liked Sam. And I feel like people have talked about, like, Sam's the real hero. And, like, there's a lot of love for Sam. But I didn't feel it until this, like, this time around. Just the dedication and just the absurd level of friendship.
Loyalty.
And selflessness.
Yeah.
Loyalty. Yeah. So beautiful.
I mean, and I think that that is one of the central things that endear this particular, you know, sort of myth of the one to people, because it actually, we see how bad Frodo is at being the one, right?
Like, he cannot stay on his own 2 feet. He falls constantly.
And he's always offering other people the ring. He's like, here, you want this thing?
He gets stabbed. He gets picked up by tentacles. Like, he's always being,
right. God. Poison foams out of his mouth constantly.
Yeah,
he has a rough time in these films, and even in Fellowship. But I think that that is the emphasis on, yes, he is the one, and he is the only one who can bear this burden. And that is a decision he ultimately has to, like, or a responsibility he ultimately has to shoulder for himself. That in itself is a powerful arc that we see him take. But also the acceptance of, I actually can't do it alone, though. I think that's really powerful, and some of our best other, like, grand myths have this element to them. Like, if you think about A New Hope, where, you know, Luke ultimately does blow up the Death Star by himself, but, you know, Han comes back and, like, swoops in, and we love to see the, you know, Luke and Han and Leia together, and, like, Harry Potter has got Ron and Hermione, and, like, he can't do it himself because Harry Potter's also bad at being the one. Like, when we get that sense of team and community and sharing the responsibility in our modern sort of myths, I think that's when they're at their most powerful. And I think this example with Frodo and Sam, I mean, all of the Fellowship, we want the Fellowship to be together, but we realize it's just, like, too many people and too much temptation. And you know, the movie does a really good job of straining those relationships and kind of fracturing them out before we get to Two Towers. But that sweetness and that the loyalty, dependency, acknowledgement piece of, this is really hard and I need help with it, I think is part of the reason we love Frodo and Sam and love these movies so much.
Well, because I feel like there's not even like a surface level of being the one is cool. Like, in Harry Potter, Harry Potter gets to do cool magic and go on all these fun adventures. And, like, Luke Skywalker,
he's kind of famous in, like, a way that's fun.
Yeah.
Right. And, like, yeah, Luke gets, like, if you're a Jedi, you get to at least have a lightsaber and, like, fly in space. Like, you get to do cool things in almost every other, like, the one story that we have. And, like, for Frodo, like, it's nothing only cool about the burden. It's like, you get these moments with your, like, dear friend. But otherwise, it's just hard. And I feel like it makes, you know, it just makes his willingness to be the one that much more compelling.
Yeah.
He's basically almost like a sacrificial lamb. Like, it's like, Frodo, we need your body to carry this ring. It's going to kill you, basically. And it kind of, we'll get to it in Return of the King, but it kind of does.
Yeah.
And and so it's really a story of like total sacrifice on his part. And then Sam just being the best and getting his body actually into the volcano.
Yep.
But it is cool that this movie does have room for them as a group to be heroes. And yeah. I think yes. it has just the best hero shot of all time of the Fellowship after being formed, like yes. cresting the mountain.
Yep, yep.
With the Fellowship theme blasting for the first time in like full blast.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, that's just 100% cinematic win. Like, what else do you want from a movie?
Right.
At that moment. Yeah.
Yeah. So you have the hobbits who are very endearing and compelling, but have no skills, right? Mm-hmm. And so when we were talking about Jaws, we talked about the like, team assembly and how it's really smart character design to have your protagonist have all of the willpower and responsibility, but none of the skills. And that's Frodo to a T. He has zero skills. But Sam doesn't have any more skills, particularly, and neither do the other two hobbits. You have Gandalf, very skilled, very cool, but he does, you know, get captured at a certain point in this movie. So I think that the supporting character design, and particularly Aragorn, who I think is this probably the second protagonist, if you want to say that, of this entire series.
Yeah, right.
Is a really, really smart design because he has all of the skills, but basically none of the willpower where he doesn't want any responsibility. So you have sort of the inverse strengths that we have from Frodo and Sam, who are just like pure force of will. We're tiny hobbits and can't do anything and we're going to go to Mordor. And then you have Aragorn who's like, I can go to Mordor. I have no problem with that. I have a huge sword and all of this like skill and like I'm a ranger and blah, blah, blah. I'm all of this worldly wise ranger dude.
And I'm like 80 years old or something.
Right.
87. Thank you very much.
87.
A natural long life, unnaturally gorgeousness, good looks. But he has his own problems with responsibility where he doesn't want to be the king and has tried to avoid it pretty much his entire life. Mm-hmm. And so it's really cool to see that. You have somebody like Legolas and Gimli who have their own sort of unique version of skills that they bring to this, but they also bring in that note of like a descent and conflict that, you know, every great team needs to create that ebb and flow. And then, of course, Boromir is the perfect mirror image of Aragorn, where he has all the responsibility and he has the skills, but he's sort of weak-willed about it, where he, you know, wants the ring for himself. He has natural human temptations.
He's really what Aragorn is afraid that he will become. Mm-hmm. You know, he's afraid of power in a way that Boromir wants to seize power and use it.
Mm-hmm. And look, if you need someone to have an epic death scene, Sean Bean's your guy.
Sean Bean.
I think it's his best. Like, I know he has a lot of good ones.
It's a good one.
Like, this is one of the best death scenes, I think, in like movie history. Also,
this is some big arrows.
For sure.
Right.
With Aragorn, though, the fact that Viggo Mortensen was a last minute replacement is just the most bonkers thing ever because he's just like one of the few characters, or not one of the few, but. If I had to like rank the character, the actors you could not replace with anybody, it would like he would be way up there, maybe just under
Big
Ian
time.
McKellen. Mm-hmm. And he like got off the plane and had to film the Weathertop fight the next day. And,
ridiculous.
Yeah. And he's such it's great because he's such a dedicated actor, too. He was so interested in what every facet of the story was. He would go to the costumers and say, how do I sharpen the sword? And if you know, when we're on the go, and they'd say, good point, and they'd craft a little whetstone pocket for him, you know. And he was like always asking questions about like, where did this come from, that kind of thing, which, you know, could probably be a little bit annoying, but it's Viggo Mortensen, he's really pretty, so he just seemed like he was such a great person to have around as the sort of leader of this cast, but also this fellowship. And again, just the fact that Stuart Townsend could have been the character just seems
just
so
mind-boggling.
Yeah.
He's part of that lightning in the bottle thing of how did this miracle happen, because he's also this really unique actor. Like, he has this energy and this kind of old soul quality to him,
very
almost
much.
Like a little bit like almost androgynous at times. Like he's masculine but in this very interesting way, and all those qualities add up to a really interesting, like, lead hero, which could be really boring. There could be a very generic approach to this character as just like moody sword swinging guy who gets to be king at the end. But instead, he's a really, you just feel there's a lot of history behind this character, a lot of depth and a lot of like inner, like an inner world happening inside of Aragorn throughout the saga. So, man, yeah, what a stroke of luck they got him at that last second.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, the performance is amazing. The writing of the character, though, is also really smart because he's so reserved.
Right. He's quiet.
It gives him, yeah, it gives him that air of mystery that really works. So, like, think about the first scene in which we meet him where they're at that tavern. And he's got the cloak over half of his face. Just like, I don't know who that is, but I want to talk to him.
I like his chin.
Not my thought, but yeah.
You have to, in order to find out anything about him, you have to directly ask him, or, and he probably won't tell you, or basically you're going to find yourself in a situation where it's going to be revealed that he speaks Elvish and he grew up with the elves. But
right.
It all just sort of comes out of, you know, sort of being forced to reveal more and more about himself. That reticence that we feel about his sense of like leadership and how that he does not want to be a leader. He does not want to be a king. Mm-hmm. Extends into all of these other aspects of the character writing and personality, right? So he has to have like this sort of quiet presence and confidence. And he does, the way that you're talking about, Alex, where you gravitate toward him. There's something very magnetic, not just about how gorgeous he is, but also he carries himself with this like, yeah, groundedness, weightiness, sense of history, all the things you're talking about. And at the same time, he doesn't extend himself any further than he needs to. There's this reluctance that is so important to see it drawn out over the course of these three movies, where it's like, you have the potential. Anybody can look at you and see that you have the potential, but you don't want it for whatever reason. And like, pulling that out and pulling that out and pulling that out becomes the work of the screenplay over the course, all three of these screenplays. And I know that that's a change from the book. And it's like one of the most brilliant changes that they could have made. Like, instead of having a character walking in going, I'm the king now.
Right.
Right. Like,
right.
Giving us instead this sort of mysterious person. It's just, oh, what good supporting character design.
They basically made him an introvert, which is cool. You know, it's like an introverted fantasy hero, which is, you're not expecting.
Yeah, there's totally. The old, I forget who said it, but the sort of old adage that the people who least want to rule are the people most qualified to rule, and the people who want to rule, you know, that kind of thing. Yeah, so that's very much reflected in Aragorn, and reflected in the opposite direction in Boromir. Who is clearly, you know, Boromir, and then you get more with Denethor as you get into the second and third movie. But this the idea of, well, why shouldn't we have this power, you know?
Right. Mm-hmm.
And I do really miss Boromir in the following movies.
Me too.
I just love him. Like, I love Sean Bean. Like, he's just great, obviously. But having that like local antagonist is is nice. Like, it creates. There's just always this sense of, danger, even when they're working together as a team. And some of the other people have that generally, where like elves and dwarves don't get along and they might like yell at each other. But Sean Bean is like, he's on your team and you need him, but also he's the biggest threat that you have right now. And so I just really enjoy that dynamic being ever present, and especially watching it again, because you know, again, the first time I saw it, I was like, I don't understand who this person is and how he's not, somebody's a king, but somebody's a steward of a place. And so he's not really the king.
That's kind of a problem with Fellowship. Even in the extended cut, you still don't really have a sense of what Gondor is or like what, like what they're talking about.
Nope.
And there's so much weight put on, like, you know, he has a whole speech to Aragorn about the Towers of Ithilien and like, have you ever seen it? It's like, I kind of want to see it. So I know what you're talking about. We'll see it eventually. And we see it for a split second when Gandalf goes there to read some scrolls, but we don't know what it is. Anyway, so there's a lot of like talk of Gondor without having any visual reference. And that's rough for like a first time viewer or somebody who hasn't watched the whole trilogy. You only really understand what they're talking about upon reflection.
Right. But I feel like the performances and the drama there get the point across.
Sure. Yeah.
Like, there was a power struggle. And I love how sad Boromir is about himself after he tries to take the ring from Frodo, and I think that's why I love his death seen so much is that it's like this mini redemption.
It
of
is.
Like, I've mm-hmm. failed, and the last thing I can do is like sacrifice my life for. I just like. Just the climax of this movie is also like amazing, I think. Like the entire battle scene, and as you know, Frodo is trying to escape and the Fellowship is kind of splintering. It's just so cool. Like it's a fun action scene, but it also has all these character moments and Boromir sacrificing himself and the way he dies and like arrow after arrow, and he's going to fight through until he just can't anymore. So you really hate that guy. So then the buildup when like
the boss battle is great with Aragorn, right, and the big Uruk-hai.
Right. And he so like good. Stabs him and it's like, okay, he did it, but no, he didn't. He's pulling him into the, it's like, what? And then he cuts off his head. It's like, yeah, that's so cool. Anyway, so I just love, I feel like this scene also, or this movie has maybe the best climax for me anyway, because it's small enough scale yeah. that I can follow everything. And there's emotionality attached to each part that you're cutting between. And you get to see Legolas kill people with his bow and arrow. And I think that's when these movies won me over, actually, is when I saw what the elves could do. And I was like, oh, I'm an elf. I want to be an elf and I want to do that. Awesome. Okay, well, so there's so much to talk about with Lord of the Rings, but luckily we do have two more episodes to come. So why don't we go around and say what lessons we're going to take from Fellowship of the Ring? So I really love the buildup to Moria. Just the entire Moria sequence, mm-hmm. I think, is excellently set up and then executed action thriller. It's kind of like how we talked about in, I think, Jaws and like Alien, like all these movies where they spend the first half of the movie mm-hmm. building up the monster so that then the second half you understand the power and why it's scary, and it makes that so much more thrilling. I feel like the Moria sequence basically works in that way, where we know that Gandalf doesn't want to go there. We know that the dwarves woke up something bad. So they say that they're forced to go that way anyway. You see, even before they get in, you know, they get to the door and there's like a riddle and they're trying to figure out how to open the door. Like there's ominous like shots of the lake. You know, something bad mm-hmm. is in that lake. But then they get in through the door and it's like, okay, well, I guess the lake stuff didn't matter. But then they have to come back out because it's like, no, Moria is worse than we thought. But then when they come back out, the lake has a big monster in it. And so mm-hmm. they have to go inside. So just even that back and forth has a like, you know, a buildup of tension that then gets to explode and traps them in Moria. And then it kind of resets and has that same buildup again where they're going through and it's dark and it's quiet. And then they find the tomb. And then is it Merry or is it Pip?
It's Pippin.
Yeah. Fool of a Took.
It's always Pippin.
Yeah. I feel so bad for him because he literally causes all the problems like, yeah. across yeah. the
He's
movies.
He's my favorite. Yeah. I know.
It's true.
I'm sorry, Gandalf. I saw a white tree in a courtyard of stone.
Anyway, so it just, when he, you know, touches the armor that falls down the well, that makes all the noise, that then awakens everything that is bad to come yes. at them, mm-hmm. you're afraid. Like they've spent enough time mm-hmm. building up that fear. And then it's the fight scene that happens is like epic and cathartic and such a cool fight. And I remember even just like watching the making ofs and like it was, you know, CGI at some point, we can talk about this in the Two Towers, because this was a big turning point
yeah.
for CGI.
Oh my God, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And especially, we'll talk about Gollum and all that stuff for sure. Anyway, so the catharsis of then seeing that fight scene explode and the reveal of the huge troll and then that building too. But we know there's something even worse.
Right.
And it's the Balrog. And so it mm-hmm. just, it has this great flow, that whole sequence of build tension. And then once the like the rock has been pushed to the top of the mountain, it just starts rolling and it picks up speed and it doesn't stop until Fly, You Fools. And it's just such an amazing sequence.
I think it's a model of a midpoint to an end of act two mm-hmm. descent. Mm. It is like one of the best that I've, and it's a literal descent, but like one of the best ever, in my opinion, where from the minute of the, you know, the Fellowship gets together and then like the journey goes well, essentially starts to go worse and worse, and then just worse and worse and worse all the way down. And the whole Moria sequence is so masterful at that. And it is a huge part, a big part of why it feels as powerful, I guess, as it does, is what you're talking about, Michael. It's the foreshadowing mm-hmm. where the the screenwriters are so good. And I know this is different than the book, because in the book, Gandalf was the one who wants to go through Moria, right? And so in this movie, it's a perfect example of closing off all of the other logical options. All of the roads are being closed to them. And we also know that Saruman wants them to go through Moria. So there's all of these plants along the way where it's like, bad things happen there, and yet they can't go any other way. And then it leads to the perfect crisis point with the death of the mentor. It's just brilliant. And like, even though it's a really long second half of the second act, there's not a bit of it that's wasted, because every scene gets worse.
Right.
And I think it's also a brilliant choice, different from the book once again, to have Frodo be the one who has to make the call to go through Moria, which makes the aftermath of Gandalf's death so much more meaningful. You know, that amazing shot of Elijah Wood where like the single tear falls. And like the look on his face, you feel the weight that he feels of like, this is kind of my fault, basically. I chose this route and now Gandalf is dead.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, great, great writing. What a way to like ratchet it up from the book to make all these choices more personal and character driven and have heavier consequences on the characters.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
And then, of course, the most sad of them is Orlando Bloom, who says, "I cannot talk about it. For me, the grief is still too near."
He's an elf.
I liked Orlando Bloom this time around. I know, like,
I dislike him less now than I used to.
I feel like he works. Yeah, I don't know. I feel like at the time it was like,
he's such a dork.
It was cool to make fun of Orlando Bloom.
And you know who else is a dork? Will Turner, which is why he works in Pirates.
Mm. But right.
Totally.
No, but we talked about with Captain America Civil War that every act feels like its own mini movie, you know, and that's what you get, like, as you were saying, Tricia, like just the build up of the midpoint to the end of Act Two. It just feels like it's its own compact little thing that obviously ties very well to what comes before and after it.
Exactly.
In some ways, the perfection of that sequence, it makes it a little, it's a long act three that follows that because of the necessity of going through Lothlorien and the Galadriel sequence, all of which is doing important narrative work. Like, you know, Galadriel is the one who essentially like lays it out for Frodo, what he's got to do. So we need all that. And, you know, it's not just because it's in the book. You know, those scenes literally are slow, like time
they
moves
are.
Slower in the Elven Forest, and everybody walks slow and talks slow. And
it's like they were shot at 30 frames per second instead of 24 right. frames per second, right.
which they were. Yeah.
So it's that's the one part of Fellowship that if you are watching it all at once, you know, not breaking it up. Like, I actually did an experiment of breaking up the extended editions into like one disc per night, which is like one half movie per night. And that was a really fun way to watch it, because every, you know, like 2 hour movie felt kind of complete and like a fun chapter in like a 6-part series. And in that viewing, the Lothlorien scene didn't drag at all for me. It was like just kind of the midpoint of an episode. But when you're watching it all at once in a theater, I remember that kind of being like, where is this movie going? We're kind of, and I think part of it is because there's so much amazing momentum happening up through Gandalf's death.
Right.
It's like, you know, you want it to keep ratcheting up, but because of what the story is and what the book is, you have this lull for a while.
I feel like Kate Blanchett turning green always kind of wakes you up, though. Like, I feel like it's a...
Instead of a Dark Lord, you would have a queen!
I really could not care less about Lothlorien. I'm so sorry. Yeah. It looks cool, I guess, you know?
It's so shiny. And like, if you look at her eyes, you know, there's like, they held up like a net of Christmas lights so that her eye lights would, like, the catches would be like magical. I like the elves. I don't know.
Definitely like broke my brain when she turned green on the first viewing. And like, it's like, what is happening?
Yeah.
Yeah. Cool. So
was your lesson, I guess.
Well, it was I feel like foreshadowing, right?
Right. There's a lot of lessons, and they're all kind of like they blend together because there's just so much to take away.
Totally. But
Alex, what's your lesson?
My lesson is about the way magic is portrayed in these movies. And there's something that I think was really a smart choice. I mean, this movie came out the same year as the first Harry Potter movie, which is a very like CG, I would say, bouncy kind of magic.
Well, the Chris Columbus versions, especially, right? The first couple of movies. Yeah.
Right.
We can talk about bounciness in The Two Towers.
Sure,
Continue.
But, well, I'm talking about magic, though. Like the actual use of magic is kind of invisible. It's like an invisible nature of magic. You know, the way Gandalf and Saruman, like, wield magic. You don't see like something come out of their staff and swirl around and like become a monster. Like it's all kind of, it's like, it's more like Jedi Force powers, if anything, like in that scene in the tower. So I think it's a really smart choice because one, the movie's aged better because of that. I think there's something really cool about seeing Saruman bring down the mountain with like a lightning bolt. That's like a timeless image. That's not like a weird 20 years ago image. And I also like how the magic isn't like an all powerful thing. Like nobody's Superman in these movies. Like Gandalf is very like fallible and he sometimes lacks confidence and is really unsure of himself, especially in the first half of the film. The way Ian McKellen plays Gandalf is he's not this mentor figure who's like super badass, who knows everything. Like he is kind of worried that he made a mistake maybe with Bilbo and this ring and like, oh crap, maybe it's too late. Maybe like, keep it here, Frodo. I'm in a rush. I got to go find out what this ring is. And I really think that's it's a great choice because you don't feel safe. You don't feel like Gandalf has it. You know, he's always also kind of scrambling and a little bit confused and worried and scared. So yeah, I think it helps to add to that sense of darkness and danger in this trilogy that there is no, you know, there's not an all-powerful magic mentor that can definitely save the day. He is as fallible as the rest of the characters. And even though he does save them, you know, he has to sacrifice himself in Moria. So, yeah.
Yeah, you get the sense that, and this was going to be part of my lesson, but you get the sense that he himself is intimidated by like the magic in the world, right? Sort of in the same way that Jedi are, where it's like the Force is so much bigger than we are. Like we can do things with the Force, and like Gandalf and Saruman are both sort of like wielding magic, but you get the feeling that it doesn't come from them necessarily, that they're kind of messing with things that are out of their control to an extent. And that does like create that sense of precariousness or a lack of safety that I think is super important for the, you know, the entire sort of theme of this movie about the difficulty of the journey. And I love the scene in Moria where Gandalf is sitting there going like, I don't know which way to go. Like,
right. He's very honest too and kind of like funny in that way. He's just like, I don't know. This way smells better, so screw it.
Totally.
That the magic is invisible does let there be like mystery to it. That I think in this case does work. Like I don't really need to know the rules of the magic in this particular instance.
Right.
Which is actually the rest of my lesson, which is you don't have to explain every single little thing, basically. Where I tried to read these books after the movies came out and I got really bogged down in them because I was like, nothing's happening. I've been reading about this history thing and this language thing for, you know, pages and pages. And I, you know, there's no action going on. This particular adaptation with Fellowship does a really excellent job of not telling us more than we need to know in the moment, which I think is just really, I don't know. It's so smart. Like you want to know more about hobbits and hobbit life. Like, you know, you want to know more about Michael doesn't. He's shaking his head.
I think Michael's the only person in the world who doesn't want to live in Hobbiton and like enjoy the Shire. Right.
That sounds terrible.
You're wrong.
I so want to be in a I want to be in a hobbit hole with my baked goods and garden and lush green fields.
I think hold on, are we just learning because like Mad Max we talked about you don't like sand because it's coarse and it gets everywhere, but like
you also hate grass.
Right, do you just not like the outdoors?
I mean, yeah, no, no one likes the outdoors. People think they like
a lot
the
of people
outdoors.
Like the outdoors.
People like to visit the outdoors. Nobody lives in the outdoors anymore.
Wow. Okay.
This is a whole spin-off conversation.
You can live in a little cute hobbit hole in the middle of the outdoors and it'd be lovely.
Yeah. Right? Brian and I are going to talk about our trips to New Zealand next time we're talking and how beautiful it is, Michael. Anyway.
Trips. Yeah.
But yeah, so this movie just does a good job of staying focused on the characters and staying focused on what we really need to know at any given moment. And I agree with you. It can be disorienting at times where I'm like, what the hell is Gondor? I don't understand a lot of the politics and other things about this world. Why do elves and dwarves hate each other? No one ever tells me that, right? Like,
well,
the Hobbit movies.
We do get some answers in the Hobbit movies.
Oh, good.
Have fun.
But I just think that the movie does a really good job of staying focused. And it reminded me, so we did a video on exposition when we were talking about The Matrix. And one of the like original lessons that we had talking about The Matrix was save exposition that isn't needed until like late, much later on. Mm-hmm. And this movie is really good at, it gives us some stuff up front, and but it also sprinkles a bunch of it throughout. And then some of it, it just leaves out completely. And I think that's part of why we're able to stay hooked into the characters, where we are just sort of forced to go with what we know. The simplicity of the myth, the simplicity of the journey, and the in right. the characters' inner conflicts. Because we're not constantly thinking about how does the magic work or why are elves immortal? Some of us still wonder about that, but we don't need to know it to enjoy Fellowship.
We'll get into the Arwen stories in the next couple movies.
So many questions. So many questions.
Yeah. Well, and I think it's like, it's a, what's nice about the Fellowship is that it does, like you're saying, have this simplistic story at its core. So it doesn't need to worry about explaining that stuff. Like, I don't need to know why Gandalf and Saruman can trip each other with their staffs. Like, they're fighting. It's fine.
Yeah.
Right.
Whereas in The Two Towers and in Return of the King, you do need to understand like what's going on in the world.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. So,
yeah.
Awesome. Brian, what's your lesson?
So my lesson is actually about the humor in these movies, where, you know, we talked about how everybody was so committed to taking this production seriously and how that comes through. And it, I think it comes through not only the production, but also in the writing and the directing, where everyone believes in this world, which means you never get a wink to the camera or anybody throwing the story under the bus. You never get a character going, a magic ring, a wizard, like, what is this nonsense? You know, you might get the occasional, they have a cave troll. You don't get the movie never once is going, hey, we know this is goofy, but stay with us. They're saying, this is not goofy. This is what it is. But these movies are really funny. And I think what's cool is that the humor doesn't come from making fun of the movie or the situation. The humor comes by writing characters with a sense of humor. So you have the ones that you come to mind the most is Merry and Pippin and Gimli. Their character design is that they crack jokes and they always find the humor and everything. So they are making jokes because the characters are making jokes, not because the writer is writing a joke that this character is going to say straight-faced, you know? But then you also have all the other characters. You have Gandalf, who's really funny and, you know, not just Ian McKellen's incredible performance, which we'll get into more, but just Gandalf loves making jokes and, you know, that kind of thing. And then even Aragorn and Legolas and, you know, everybody can find humor in a situation and can find joy in a situation. And because those characters are finding the humor and the joy in this epic sort of bleak situation, we as the audience are experiencing that joy too. And I think that goes such a long way into making these big, overwhelming movies feel enjoyable and entertaining to watch. And it makes you feel like you want to be part of this world and kind of spend time with these characters.
Mm-hmm.
No, absolutely. I think the levity, as we've said many times, is like helps you be willing to go to the dark places.
Yeah.
Like if it's just dark, then it's not dark. Like the dynamics are important. And when it's fun, it's fun. So like put fun in to your adventure.
Yeah.
It's a lovely experience. And it maybe didn't have to be. Like that's maybe not the obvious choice to make a movie about, you know, a death sentence to take a ring to the devil. Like that maybe doesn't have to be fun.
Because I think there's a world in which someone says, we're taking this really seriously, therefore it has to be serious.
Grim.
Therefore we have to make, you know, like the most somber kind of staunch version of this. And that's not what they made, thankfully.
Yeah. The Zack Snyder version.
Yeah, right.
Where everybody's already dead.
High contrast.
Cool. Well, why don't we go around and say what, besides The Lord of the Rings and The Hobbit movies, we have managed to be watching recently. Trisha, what have you been watching recently?
I have a 2021 movie for y'all.
Whoa.
So what? It's 5 days into... Okay.
I know. This one dropped on VOD on January 1st, and that is the day that I watched it. It is a movie called Shadow in the Cloud, starring Chloe Grace Moretz, And it's directed by, written and directed by a filmmaker named Roseanne Lang. It's also a New Zealand co-production. Mm. This is a World War II fantasy action horror movie.
Question mark?
Yeah. So Chloe Grace Moretz plays a female World War II pilot, which, as you guys know, is in my interest because I wrote a book about mm-hmm. women Air Force service pilots in World War II. They did exist. They flew planes. So she plays.
The book is called Taking Flight, the Nadine Ramsey story, available on Amazon now.
Thank you so much, Brian. Yeah. So they're a really remarkable group of women in history that really haven't been written much about. But this movie takes a you know, one of these women Air Force service pilots, essentially, and drops her into this very contained sort of like weird horror thriller thing. She's essentially stowing away on a cargo plane. And there's a male crew that they find out she's there and they're just like being sexist and terrible to her. But then there's this sci-fi sort of fantasy element that comes in. And I don't want to tell you too much about it. You should just watch the trailer for it. The trailer will tell you all you need to know about it. It is goofy. It is weird. It is like really contained and low budget and just like an inventive, bizarre way to do this kind of like actiony thing. It's just a lot of fun. I don't know. It checked a lot of my boxes. And at the end, they have all of this real footage of women Air Force service pilots, both from Britain, who flew with the Air Transport Auxiliary, and from the United States, the women Air Force service pilots, the WASPs. They have all this real footage of these real women, including some that are in my book. So I like they popped up on screen during the credits and nice. I was like, oh my God, it's Barbara London. And like women that I just got to research and write about when I was working on my book. So there's
that's so cool.
This movie is totally not historically accurate. Is it about gremlins? Maybe. But it's like it's, I don't know, cool and fun and bizarre. And yeah, it's great. Shadow in the Cloud. You can check it out on VOD. It's streaming in a couple different places.
Very cool. Alex, what have you been watching?
So I watched Sound of Metal on Amazon Prime. It's a really awesome movie starring Riz Ahmed. He's a heavy metal drummer who starts to lose his hearing, which just totally upends his life. It's a really well done, beautiful character study of this guy, and Riz Ahmed's performance, like, give him all the awards. He is so good in this role. So yeah, not much more to say besides just it's a beautiful, well-done character study with a great central performance. I really, really loved it. And it does really interesting things with sound design. So watch it with some good speakers or headphones because they really play with his experience of losing his hearing and going in and out of that. And it's just top to bottom, beautifully done movie, Sound of Metal.
Cool.
Very cool.
I will second that. Olivia Cooke is also in it, and she is awesome. And yeah, the sound design stuff is really cool. They do things where when the camera is over his shoulder, you are hearing, you know, a certain sound design. But then when the camera is sort of like just in the room watching characters, then you're hearing what's actually going on in the space. Hmm. And yeah, really, really beautiful film that I just watched too.
Nice.
Awesome. Cool. Well, what else have you been watching, Brian?
In addition, since we are recording on January 5th, I watched Death to 2020 on Netflix, which is by Charlie Brooker and Annabelle Jones, who created Black Mirror. And it's a mockumentary similar to Charlie Brooker's Screen Wipe, which if you're a British listener, you'll probably be familiar with. It just details the events of 2020 using interviews with the cast of mostly fictional characters. So the characters are played by Sam Jackson, Hugh Grant, Lisa Kudrow, Leslie Jones, Kumail Nanjiani, Krista Milioti, and a few other like British faces that you might recognize. Tracy Ullman as the Queen, Queen Elizabeth Part Two, I think she refers to herself as, and it's narrated by Lawrence Fishburne. And it's been reviewed poorly as not being like of the caliber of Black Mirror or Screen Wipe. I didn't watch it expecting it to be. I kind of imagine they threw this thing together like a month ago or something, just to sort of be like, let's just kind of, we need kind of to take a breath. It's only 70 minutes or so, and it's fun and irreverent. And then a couple of times it actually gets kind of serious where you're not expecting it to. So it does a nice little when your guard's down kind of thing. And it's just, you know, it's been a ridiculous year, and it was just kind of a nice way to sort of shut it down.
Yep.
Yeah.
It's been a Black Mirror of a year, that's for sure.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, goodness.
Shut it all down.
Yeah. So I've been continuing to watch Mandalorian because season two happened. And everyone was like, oh my God, like it saved Star Wars and everyone else, it's the best thing ever.
But
and so I finished the first season. So I'm not caught up yet, but it made me go back and finish the first season because I had made it 3 episodes in.
Wow.
And someone was like, episode 4 is when stuff starts to happen. So I watched episode 4 and I was like, oh, this is really good. I enjoyed this. And then it kind of went back to like stuff not happening for a little bit. And then like the final 2 episodes, like stuff kind of happened. And I was like, hey, well, stuff kind of happened. Anyway, long story short, if you revisit our Star Wars episode where I talked about the Mandalorian, my feelings have not really changed, but I'm excited to start season 2 and see where they go with it.
This is not selling me on investing in this first season.
I'm excited to hear what you have to say about season 2 when you have finished it, which hopefully you will.
Yeah. I don't know if I need to hear what you have to say. I love it. I don't need Star
I didn't say
Wars
I needed to hear it. I said I'm interested
Scrooge in my life. Get out of here.
See, and I think there's a really interesting conversation at some point to be had about like what Star Wars is to different people.
Sure.
Because I think that's what's like experiencing this has shown me is that like we all started from the same place, but what Star Wars means to people is clearly very different for different people.
Hmm.
So that's just kind of an interesting thing to be thinking about in the background. But I'll report in once I've finished season 2 because I'm excited because I hear things and blah, 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 but I won't say them out loud.
Okay.
Awesome. This has been our conversation on the first Lord of the Rings film, The Fellowship of the Ring. Thank you again to the patrons that made this possible and made it happen, helped us get to our goal. We'll be announcing our new goal soon, coming up soon. And next week, we will be back with The Two Towers as we continue our journey through Middle Earth. Beyond the Screenplay is produced by Vince Major, and our editor is Eric Schneider. I'm Michael Tucker, and I've been joined today by Trisha Rand, Brian Bittner, and Alex Calleros. All of our Twitter handles are in the show notes. Send us a tweet and let us know your thoughts on The Fellowship of the Ring. And patrons, head into the Discord, and let's start talking about The Lord of the Rings. And I want to hear everybody's like journeys with them, and when they saw it, and how they feel about it now, and how it's aged. I think there's a lot of like film history like wrapped up and also just this funness of Lord of the Rings. So I look forward to all the conversations on our Discord. Thank you everyone for listening, and we will see you next week in our episode on The Two Towers.
Bye everybody.
Bye bye.
Bye.